From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, communicating with the other side, a classic Coast to Coast show for you tonight. Here's what's happening. The Vatican is launching a new international exorcism training course in response to rising demand for priests skilled in getting rid of demonic possessions. What an amazing story. A week-long course on exorcism is set to be held in April at a Catholic educational institute in the capital of Italy. The focus of the course is to offer what they call a rich reflection and articulation on a topic that is sometimes unspoken and controversial. It's an amazing story. It really is. A New York Police Department says three people attacked a barber in the Bronx who got angry at a client for refusing to pay for a haircut. Boy, the hate continues, doesn't it? The New York Police Department says barbers who witnessed the altercation say the 53-year-old barber was initially the aggressor, as the barber refused to let the client leave without paying for a haircut that he did not like. The client then hit the barber with a brush, then exited outside, getting into a fight with the barber there. A violent storm system with relentless rains and fierce winds that pounded the southern and central U.S. over the weekend could lead to treacherous flooding in the days ahead. The system that stretched from Texas to the Canadian Maritime provinces left a path of destruction as it cut eastward Sunday. Homes were leveled, trees uprooted, cars demolished, at least five people killed, two suspected in tornadoes. Emergency crews struggle to keep up with calls from drivers stranded by rising floodwaters in many locations. And flooding will continue to be a threat this week as more rain falls and runoffs continue. AccuWeather said that more than 200 river gauges reported levels above flood stage from the Great Lakes to eastern Texas. Let's check in with the weatherman, Scott Stevens. Scott, what's causing all of this?
You know, George, this is just that time of year where these things happen. We don't have a lot of vegetation that's greened up. We have lots of soil that is still frozen when you get below 2, 3, 4 inches down. Or the frost has just come out and the ground just isn't ready to soak up 2, 3, 6, 8, 9 inches worth of rain that happens in 48 hours. That's a lot of water for the rivers that still have ice and ice jams to digest.
What do you recommend, Scott, for people who, I've seen cars try to go through little areas that seem flooded, and they get swept away. What do you recommend there? Don't go through them.
I went looking for stories after you guys called this morning, and there's every one of these incidences, there's somebody caught on video doing the dumb thing. And it's just Darwin's Law.
Absolutely. Well, folks, be careful. Scott Stevens, of course, weatherwars.info. Sales of newly built homes are falling, and the culprit is clear. Homebuyers increasingly cannot afford what they want. Higher mortgage rates combined with loss of homeowner tax breaks now in some of the nation's most expensive markets are taking away buying power. What a very strange, sad story. In early January, a 27-year-old Kylie Lane went to the hospital for what she thought was the flu. A month later, the mother is hooked up to a machine and fighting for her life in intensive care at a unit at the University of New Mexico Hospital in Albuquerque. At first, Lane was experiencing flu-like symptoms. She felt nauseous, had a sharp stomach pain. Finally, her husband convinced her, let's go get you checked out. The pair went to a hospital in their hometown of Farmington, New Mexico, where doctors told her she had some blockage, so they just gave her some laxatives and sent her home. Weeks later, she returned with shortness of breath. At one point, they thought she might be faking it, but Lane's condition continued to get worse, and she had to be put on a ventilator. Finally, one of Lane's tests came back positive for hantavirus. This is a rare illness usually spread through the contact with infected deer mice. The virus is rare. As of January of 2017, a total of 728 cases had been reported across 36 states. The majority of the cases were reported in states west of the Mississippi River. The virus, which kills a reported 36% of the victims, cannot be transmitted from one person to another. Older people in Wales are being urged to think about donating their brains after they die to help scientists research dementia. Researchers at Cardiff University are not actively recruiting at the moment, but are still keen to hear from people aged over 85 without a diagnosis. Look up in the skies. What do you see? No, not Superman. You might see Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, George. Wow, what a week we begin with as we wrap up February here. But you and I were talking a few shows ago about the Tiangong-1 space station.
That's right. The Chinese one. Where will it go when it crashes, right?
Exactly. It's like a big roulette wheel. And here's an update on this. This 18,000-pound spacecraft, George, is now in that area of about 158 miles above the Earth. Now, that's kind of scraping the upper Earth's atmosphere. Put it in perspective, the International Space Station orbits at a relatively safe distance of 250 miles up. So here's the scoop. We'll not know, according to space scientists, the orbital decay elements exactly until simply days before reentry. But there is hope. Most of these spacecraft, if they're positioned right, go into the spacecraft graveyard in the South Pacific, simply known as Point Nemo, one of the most remote places on Earth, about 1,450 miles from any major landmass, minus 40 degrees southern latitude, 123 degrees west longitude. We're hoping it goes there. But George, in the live sky, which everybody loves, the moon obviously moving on to full. Here's some trivia. February has no full moons. It hasn't happened since 19 years ago that we've had this, 1999 to be exact, and before that, 1980. The next full moon occurs on March the 1st. It's simply known as the beautiful full warm moon, as soil in some parts of the country hopefully starts to thaw out. But March will have two full moons, and that the second time here in the year of 2018. Dr. Sky reminds you to always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. Email me at drsky@cox.net. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stephen. Stephen's website, of course, drsky.com, as he just mentioned. Up next, L.A. Marzulli back with us as we talk about a very strange mystery of elongated skulls. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. You know, on this program, we are always looking for the unusual and the strange and the mysterious. Well, we've got that for you tonight. L.A. Marzulli back with us, author, lecturer, filmmaker. He has penned a number of books, including the Nephilim Trilogy, and received the honorary doctorate for the series from Pacific International University. He, along with Richard Shaw, are the directors and producers of the Watcher series as well. And what we're going to be talking about tonight with L.A. is a fascinating story unfolding with a news conference in Los Angeles just a few weeks ago, which took the community by storm. L.A., welcome back, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me on, George. Always good to be here.
Looking pleasure. And, you know, I got to tell you, lots of people went wild with this news conference. Tell us how you structured it.
Well, first of all, it was held down at the Marriott, and Tom Danhauser was there, which was always good to see Tom. A lot of people showed up. I know Jaime Masson and his film crew showed up. Telemundo showed up. So, and other people, Third Phase of the Moon showed up. So we had a lot of attention, a lot of media people. And for the most part, we got pretty good press, which was fantastic. But we flew in everybody, all the researchers from all parts of the country, as far away as Washington, D.C., and, of course, Brian Forrester from Peru. And all eight of us presented one at a time, about 15 to 30 minutes each person presented. And I would say the two presentations that I felt were the obviously the most riveting were Mondo Gonzalez, our archaeologist. Mondo presented the DNA, the long-sought-after DNA result, and that was basically 58 samples that we tested. And, of course, Rick Woodward followed him up with the morphological, the structural oddities that are found in these very enigmatic Paracas skulls. So Marcia Moore ended the conference. She's a forensic artist. And she basically brings these really strange artifacts to life. She's just an incredible artist. So Richard Shaw did a 6 to 7 minute compilation of many different videos that he's taken of our different trips down to Paracas. And he sort of kicked things off. He followed me, basically. But he kicked things off. And anyone who didn't know about this after watching Rick's incredible film that was about 6 to 7 minutes really had a good overview of what had taken place in Paracas. So hats off to the entire team. It was just a great romp. I think Rick compiled a DVD. It's about almost 3 hours long of information.
Wow.
And that's just, it's just groundbreaking stuff, in my opinion.
L.A., what would the late Lloyd Pye have said about a news conference like this?
Well, it's really interesting. You know, it's like there's a lot of nonsense on the net, and sometimes people, they shouldn't do this, in my opinion, release things on the net, release information on the net. And why that's great, because it gets out, and some people get, you know, a 500,000 YouTube hits. I mean, that's okay. But the bottom line is, what I wanted to do with this, because of the nature of the subject, because the controversial nature of the subject, to be even more specific, was to hold a formal press conference where people could come in. We would live stream it, we would film it, we would create a DVD. We also have a book where all eight of us contributed to the book, so that's a compilation also. I wanted to do it right, really wanted to do it right, because, you know, this topic, first of all, some people look at it and immediately just push it aside and say, well, these elongated skulls are basically the result of cranial deformation, cranial headboarding. And that's when you take an infant and you take plant matter or boards or cloth, whatever, and you wrap the head and you shape it. And we know, but we're not disputing that. That certainly has happened all throughout the world, cranial deformation,
Right.
cranial headboarding. But what we found, and this research has gone on from 2013. That's when we went down and we saw Senior One's Museum, thanks to Brian Forrester, who set that up, and it was really up to Brian who put it on the map with his YouTube videos. So we went down there and we looked at these skulls, and it took many years and several archaeologists before we found Mondo Gonzalez, who actually stuck through it, got the paperwork done, and this was took months. I mean, it took months, actually years, before we got permission from the Minister of Culture to go down and take samples. But the bottom line is, archaeologists, mainstream archaeology, dismisses these skulls as a result of cranial headboarding. And when we went down there, we said, you know, guys, yeah, I get it. Some of these skulls are cranial headboarded. We understand that. We're not disputing that. But there seems to be differences in the skulls that are elongated that are not cranial headboarded. And so that's what we discovered. And that's basically the work of Rick Woodward, who's our anthropologist on the team. And he contacted me. He had been looking at these things, and we sent him all the casts I had. And then he really did some deep study with these artifacts, and what we discovered was incredible.
In LA, are you concluding that these might be truly extraterrestrial or human type of some different species?
Well, here's the deal with that. I mean, we have some information, and this is sort of what amazes me. After 5 years and all the data that we've got, and that's why we held the press conference, we never mentioned alien, we never mentioned Nephilim, we never
Right.
went there. And when I opened up the conference with my presentation, and I basically stated, we now, after 5 years of studying these, and it's certainly not exhaustive, but it's getting close to that in some ways. At least it feels exhaustive at times. But I basically stated that we have no idea what we're looking at or what these people or entities were. We just don't know. And
So there could be anything.
they could be anything. I mean, Dr. Alde, who's the medical doctor on the team, he went as far as to state that, in his opinion, he felt that they were a new species, a subspecies of humans,
Of humans,
which
okay.
I found absolutely incredible. But, you know, he's putting his reputation as a medical doctor on the line. And he arrived at, not just because of, you know, just sort of a cavalier, capricious idea. I mean, he examined these skulls and really did some due diligence. His presentation was absolutely riveting.
They look like human ants, don't they? With that kind of skull.
You know what? There's a first century historian. His name is Josephus, and I read some of his work, specifically in regard of a Nephilim. And you kind of know where I'm going to go with this, because, you
Yeah.
know, my gut. If people would ask me off the record, LA, what do you think we're looking at? I would say, well, you know, I don't know what we're looking at, but if I had to guess, I would say we're looking at the remnants of a Nephilim. That's what I'm going to go with. That's what I'm going to stick to, because that's what I believe we're looking at. Now, that's conjecture, and I can't underline that enough. That's conjecture on my part. And that's our hypothesis, has been that people fled the Levant, the Middle East, 3,500 years ago, and settled, basically left under duress because Joshua and Caleb were prosecuting the war in the Promised Land, and all these Nephilim tribes were there. So Okay, that's a scripture that's, 3,000 years old plus. But Josephus is only 2,000 years old. And Josephus tells us that the bones, the remains of the Nephilim, were on display in Jerusalem. And in other words, people could go in and look at these skeletons. And he says, and I quote, that these skeletons, the Nephilim, had countenances so different, so from normal human beings, that they were terrifying to look at. So, you look at the Paracas skulls, and that's a jump, that's a leap, and I certainly will admit that. But they are definitely strange looking. They're certainly abnormal. And while cranial deformation took place, we're saying that not all these skulls are cradle headboarded or the result of cranial deformation.
We've got pictures and video that L.A. provided us at coasttocoastam.com. If you have the capability of getting to that website, take a look at these pictures. Truly remarkable. And I've got to tell you, L.A., the elongation of some of those skulls, absolutely riveting. I mean, it defies a birth defect as far as I'm concerned.
I agree.
And in terms of elongating a skull that some societies have done in the past, these are pretty pulled out. I mean, I can't believe a skull could stretch that far.
And I certainly concur with you. And that was basically the result of Rick Woodward's, Dr. Michael Alday, Malcolm Warren, our chiropractor. All these guys got together and basically stated the same thing, that in their opinion, these were genetic. What we were looking at were genetic traits. This was not the result of cradle headboarding. That this was somehow genetic, and we can get into that in a little bit. But when we were doing a DNA testing at the ICA, the ICA Museum, and this took, this took years really to get the permission. And we walked in there with our team: Chase Klotsky, Richard Shaw, the director of Watchers, Mondo Gonzalez, our archaeologist, and myself. And we were donned head to foot in lab garb and the whole thing, and I mean lab suits. Headgear, masks, gloves, double sleeves on the full body suit, boots, the whole thing. And we changed suits after every single skull that we took samples
for sanitation purposes.
Absolutely.
You don't want to contaminate them.
To keep the contamination at a minimum. We also took DNA swabs from everybody. But I on a whim, the museum was closed that day, and there's one of the skulls, which is iconic. It's called the Chongo skull. It's in the museum. It's behind glass. And I went to Ruben Soto, the archaeologist. I said, Ruben, is there any possibility the museum's closed? Can we look at the Chongo skull? So Ruben disappears for about an hour. He comes back in. We're still doing testing. And he goes, LA, yeah, we can do that. After you're done testing, we can go back in. I'm just about ready to fall over. Because, I've been looking at this thing for years. And we go in. All the lights are off in the room. And the director of the museum flicks the lights on, and there in front of us are all the display cases. We walk over, the whole team, we walk over, plus Ruben Soto and the director and several other people walk over. They push the display case, the glass display case, away from the wall, slide back the glass door, and the woman dons a pair of gloves. She reaches in, the director reaches in, takes this huge elongated skull that says Chongos, that's in the necropolis, the graveyard from which it came from. And she takes it out of the case, and Rick's got all this on film, and she holds it up in front of us. And then we ask, turn it upside down so we can look at it. And of course, a little bit of a translation deal there, and she's not sure what we mean, and then it's translated, and she slowly rotates the skull, and you hear me on the film, I go, oh my gosh, it's all the way in the back. And what blew us away, and this is the work of Rick Woodward, our anthropologist. There's a hole in the base of a skull where the spinal column attaches to the skull. That's called the foramen magnum.
Very natural, right?
It's very natural. And in human beings, it's basically in the center of the skull. That the spinal column comes up. All the cabling, all the wires from the brain go down through the spinal column and basically dispatch to all parts of our body.
It's like a coax cable.
It's unbelievable. When you really look at it, you dissect it and you see how we're made and how this whole thing works.
Yeah, it's all electronic.
Well, yeah, it is. Praise the body electric, right? So the foramen magnum in many of the Paracas skulls and in this Chongo skull is pushed back so far that if it's any further back, it's outside the skull. That's how far back it is.
Wow. All right, and stay with us, L.A. We're going to take a quick break. We'll talk more about this. Plus, you've made a very bold claim that I want to talk with you about when we come right back. Well, we've got three live stage shows coming up, bang, bang, bang. And our most recent one is just less than 2 weeks away now in Salt Lake City, Utah, Saturday, March 10th. I'll tell you how you can go. It's going to be a grand time at the Janae Wagner Theater. We've got ancient technology expert Jason Martell joining us, the man who died twice to live to talk about it, Danion Brinkley. And ufologist Nick Pope will be joining us as well. Nick, I'm looking forward to this with you.
Hey, yes, me too. Interesting times for sure, and a great time to be talking about this subject, given that it's in the news so much.
Absolutely, and what a wonderful city for us to have our discussion. These live stage shows are just fantastic because they're so interactive with people who are in the audience, and they get a chance to ask you questions about ufology and some of the things you saw when you were at the Ministry of Defense. It's just, I'm really excited about it.
Me too. I mean, I love Salt Lake City, and this is going to be a chance to, like you say, take this out onto the road and be interactive. I think people have got so many questions about this at the moment. You know, a few months ago, people were having debates, and then it's on the front page of the New York Times, and people are saying, wait a minute, what's going on with the UFOs?
Something's happening these days with ufology, Nick, don't you think?
Absolutely. It's come out of the fringe and into the mainstream like I've never seen it before. And as I say, suddenly it's in the New York Times, it's in the Post, it's in Politico, it's on CNN, all the networks. Everyone's talking about it.
You got it. Nick, I'll see you in less than 2 weeks now, okay?
Great. Looking forward to it.
Nick Pope, and we will be at Salt Lake City at the Janae Wagner Theater. You can get tickets by going to coasttocoastam.com. At the top, hit events, and it opens up. Or you can call the box office directly at 801-355-2787. There are a couple rows in the back that they'd love for you to fill in for us, so take advantage of that. Less than 2 weeks there. Then April 21st, Scottsdale, Arizona. We've got a live show there at the Virginia Piper Theater. Looking forward to that. Then on June 9th, we're in Las Vegas, Nevada with our affiliate KXNT at the Silverton Casino. And we're having a great time there. And my colleague George Knapp will be with us along with so many other people, including a little 13-year-old who deals with the healing power of crystals. Full information again, all three events, how to get tickets, simply go to coasttocoastam.com and click events at the top of the homepage. And welcome back to Coast, L.A. Marzulli with us, George Norrie here, Elongated Skull Mystery. L.A., I'll let you finish up on where you were headed with the way that the skull is connected to the spinal cord, and then I'll ask you a few more questions.
You got it. You know, on the Coast to Coast website, they actually, the video is up there. Lex put it up, and you can actually see Bachongo's skull. And I'm looking right at it now, and she's the director is holding the skull, and we look at where the foramen magnum is, and it's pushed all the way to the rear. I mean, if it's any further back, it's outside the skull. And here's what we've, you know, during the press conference, this is what we talked about. And this is the work of Rick Woodward, Dr. Michael Alde followed up on it, Dr. Warren Malcolm, our chiropractor. The bottom line is this, George, you can't put pressure on the rear plate, the occipital plate, and move that towards the foramen magnum without killing the child. You can't do it. You can't move it. So we're looking at something which has to be genetic. It's not the result of cradle headboarding.
Right.
And this is what makes our teams, in my opinion, so unique, because it's a multidiscipline team, a multidiscipline approach to this, you know, subject. And what's incredible about it, to the best of my knowledge, is it's the only team that's ever really looked at these skulls in this sort of a way. Most archaeologists will say, immediately dismiss it and say it's all cradle headboarding. But they've never looked at the position of the foramen magnum. There's nothing in the literature that we're aware of that anyone has actually examined the foramen magnum and looked at the differences. And these are, this hole, this brain hole, for lack of a better word, the foramen magnum, is much smaller and a different shape than a normal human being. And it gets better. It's like the foramen condyles, which are these bones which sort of help the skull rock on that spinal column. Again, different shape, different size, they're more robust. It just what we discovered, and again, this, I want to just, you know, give credit where it's due. This is Rick Woodward's work for the most part. There are anomalies in these skulls. And what we're, the reason why we did the press conference is we went, we have all this data, we have all this information, we have no answers, no definitive answers, but we're kind of going, you know what, this needs a lot more study, we need more funding, we need more testing, we need to get, you know, more samples. We've just scratched the surface, and now, after 5 years, we really have more questions than answers.
Now, the fact that the skull is so elongated,
mm-hmm.
does that mean that the brain was that big too?
Again, more testing needs to be done. The preliminary testing that we did years ago at Senior Juan's Paracas Museum, and Brian Forrester was very instrumental in this, but we had several skulls that were there, and what we did is we had rice, you know, bags of rice, and we would pour the rice into the skull and up to the foramen magnum and then gently shake it and pour some more in. And then we would weigh that, pour the rice back out and weigh it in the bag. And what we discovered is that in many of the elongated skulls, the brain capacity was 25 to 30% larger than a normal human being. That shouldn't be the case. In other words, okay, you can elongate a skull, you can use cranial headboarding, cranial deformation, and shape the skull. We're not disputing that. But you can't create a larger mass. You can't have 25 to 30% more brain, you know, volume that's there than you would in a normal skull. So you start adding all these things up, and it really becomes enigmatic, mysterious.
Well, but something has to occupy the inside, right?
Well, it's more. We think it's more brain. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's got to be. Now, you have talked about how this possibly will rewrite history. That's a pretty bold claim.
It's a very bold claim, and the reason why I stated it was because the haplogroups, and most people are probably waiting for this information, what we discovered after 58 samples, and we used two labs, but the main lab was the Paleo DNA lab up in Canada. And I've been up there, I've sat down and had a meal with the geneticist up there, the Frat Pietros, they're a husband and wife team, incredible people, really dedicated to science. The lab is just absolutely spotless. It's just amazing to actually walk into a DNA lab. And they gave us a full-on tour, and Richard Sharpe, director of the Watcher series, filmed all of this, and we presented some of that evidence in one of our Watcher series. But the Paleo DNA lab in Canada did all the extractions. We did 58 samples. We had many different skulls, eight skulls, for instance, in the ICA Museum. We had skulls from Senior Juan's Paracas Museum. We had several skulls from private collectors. One was the cinnamon skull, which Ancient Aliens tested, and the other one was the we called the Oregon skull in a private collection. So we had numerous skulls, 58 samples. And out of the 58 samples, I think it was 26 or 28 actually came back with viable haplogroups. The haplogroups tell us the origin of the female line, where it originated from. And the reason why we only used 26 or 28, there were others that indicated certain haplogroups, but we didn't list those because they were too iffy. So out of the 58 samples, whatever, we've got these samples, and Mondo did a great job. He made a chart very easy to look at. It's in the book that I published, the DNA result. And what we discovered, not all the skulls, many of the skulls, showed haplogroups from Europe and the Middle East. Other skulls from origins from Asia, which is exactly what you would expect. That haplogroup is B1. B as in boy, one. You'd expect that. That's what fits the paradigm. The rebuttal to that is, well, you know, archaeologists realize now that there's more of a mixing, and that many of these skulls, you know, have a Middle Eastern and European. But what we're saying is, you know, guys, the haplogroup, the percentage of European, like E21 or T2B, which is Middle Eastern. We even had a Druze population. That just shouldn't be there. And it's not like...
But it is.
But it's there.
Yeah.
And what that means, what that may mean, and this is where it gets interesting to me. Again, our hypothesis, at least my hypothesis, has always been that about 3,500 years ago, when Joshua and Caleb pressed the conquest of the Promised Land, this is all, and I cited three different sources. I cited the Torah, the Bible, I cited the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I cited Josephus. And I made it really, really clear in the book that I'm using these only in a historic way. We're not talking anything supernatural, anything else. This is science. We're looking at, and we're saying, validating the historicity of these documents. That's all we're saying, that there was a conquest of Canaan. There seems to be these tribes that were there, the Nephilim, the Raphaim, the Anakim, the Amzumim, the Emim. Okay, they were all there, and that's part of the historical document, and I don't think people dispute that. What we're saying, and this is where sort of the dispute comes in, if there is any, that when this conquest of Canaan happened, there was a diaspora. In other words, people fled. These tribes fled the area. Some went northward. Some went out the Red Sea. Some went out the Mediterranean. They could have fled in many different directions. And no one knows. No one knows, really. Did they go across the Atlantic? Did they come across the Pacific? Did they go northward into Europe, which really wasn't inhabited so much by then? I mean, it was not like it is now, obviously, and made their way over to the New World, which I believe that they did. Thor Heyerdahl, and I showed this clip at the press conference, proved in his book, in his movie and book, Ra. Most people know Kon-Tiki, but he also did another one called Ra. And he left from basically the Mediterranean and sailed out into the Atlantic without a compass and just a sail in a papyrus boat, in a reed boat. And after several, well, I think it's like 57 days, whatever, he was out on sea, he wound up on the island of Barbados, which is the New World, without a compass. In other words, the trade winds just blew the boat right to the New World island of Barbados. So he proved in modernity that this could have happened. But the prevailing paradigm in archaeology is one of isolationism. In other words, that basically states that, well, you know, people really don't, they're not curious, they don't want to see what's over that hill, you know, beyond that river, over this ocean. Well, they're just going to stay put, and very, very slowly over thousands of years, maybe there'll be some migration. The diffusionist, of which I am one, says, oh, I don't believe that. People are curious. People are going, hey, what's over that hill? And then when they get down over that hill, then maybe they meet another tribe, and they, hey, how you guys doing? And they maybe trade and intermarry, and pretty soon, then what's over the next hill? Or what's down this river? Or what's across this body of water? And so we feel that people moved throughout the centuries, and it's a completely different paradigm than is held in academia, in the scientific community, most archaeologists. And so what's interesting is we feel, my hypothesis has been that this diaspora, 3,500 years ago, that many of these tribes fled the old world and came to the new world. What's interesting is the Paracas people show up about 3,400 years ago, which fits the timeline.
Well, if they were ETs, though, wouldn't they just get into craft and take off?
Exactly. Exactly. If it's ET, and see, here's part of the problem. We don't have the other side of the genetic equation. All we have is the mitochondrial DNA, which comes from the female side, which gives us the haplogroups, which is great. Okay, so we know where they come from, the Middle East, Europe.
Right.
But we don't have the nuclear DNA.
Which you need.
Which we desperately need. And I want to just give a plea.
And where does that come from?
It comes from the male side of the family.
No, but I mean in terms of what the samples.
You got to get a lot of it. You got to get a lot of sample.
And it would come from the bone? From where?
Well, the teeth. But it's, in other words, ancient DNA is so degraded that you've got to coax the nuclear DNA out. Like the Oregon skull, we got a little bit of nuclear DNA, but not enough to really sequence. And if, for instance, there was a gentleman who emailed me after the last time I was on coast and stated, you know, I was down in Bolivia, I'm from Bolivia, in 1974, I brought back an elongated skull, and he showed me the skull, showed me the picture. And I wrote the guy and I said, I'm very interested in this, because what I would do is I would purchase the skull, and I would take that skull and have him ship it right to the paleo DNA lab. We would take photographs of it, and I would say to the lab, take the whole skull and grind it down, literally. Take the whole thing. We need nuclear DNA. Take as many samples as you need. Take all the teeth, whatever it takes, to get nuclear DNA. And then we need a geneticist to really interpret the data. they can interpret it on some level. They could look at the gen banks and say, well, we got an unknown primate here. And that may be the case, but we don't know. We have no idea what the other side of the genetic equation looks like. And that, until we get that, we're just kind of, you know, on a cliffhanger, essentially, just kind of going, what are we really looking at here? Because we don't know.
We don't know. Jeez, but what a great discovery, isn't it? How many skulls have they found?
There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of them. We know that at Julio Tello Museum in Lima, for instance, there's something called the Skull Room. I've heard, I've never been able to vet this, they had 10,000 skulls there. And when I was there, we got to meet the director. This is several years ago, about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. We met at that time a director, and she came out, and we had an interpreter. And I asked her, one of my first questions, I said, well, has anyone done any DNA sampling on any of the skulls? And she looked at me and she said, no. And I just about fell over. I'm just sitting here going like, you know, you have 10,000 skulls, roughly, and 300 mummy bundles.
Makes no sense.
It makes no sense. And no one's doing doodly squat.
Why not?
That's the question. Why is it that certain people, and I won't mention their names or give them a platform, without looking at our data, without looking at the data, without reading the book, without seeing what the DNA says, without looking at the morphological differences found by our anthropologist, the guy's a real anthropologist, and, you know, is putting his name on the bottom line here, putting his reputation, why haven't these people who have written disparaging, you know, remarks or sort of hit pieces on our work, why haven't they looked at the data?
Are these people haters or are they scientific people?
They're just people who have a platform and just say, well, it's a slow day in the news world, so...
Let's attack L.A. and Rick and all those people.
What was that, George?
Let's attack L.A. Right?
Well, that's what they do. And look, all we're saying is, I don't care what you think of me, but look at the data. Look at what the data says. Attack the data. Look at the morphological differences. Look at the DNA. What's going on here? You know, there was this little skull. We were down there Brian Forrester showed us. We called it the baby skull, and it was found. I've been to the site where the grave was, and we got to unwrap this thing. And so we did DNA testing. There were three different tests done on this particular skull, the baby skull. Two at the Paleo DNA lab and one at another lab. No collusion between the labs. They both came back U2E1, which is European. So it was tested three different times. And here's the deal, George, and this is where people need to understand. When we're sending these samples to these labs, they have no idea what they're looking at. They've got some powder, they've got a bit of bone, a little bit of hair, whatever. And this is all legal, all done with I've got the stamp, the sealed letter with my name on it, my passport number, Minister of Cultures. You know, there's the seal, L.A. Marzulli, blah, 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 is allowed to bring this into the United States, which is just incredible. It was just a wonderful letter to get after spending thousands of dollars and several years and all the paperwork to get to that point. The bottom line is, when the lab is looking at this, they have no dog in the hunt. They're just doing the science. They take the sample, they prepare the sample, it goes through through their process, and they give you the result. And that's what we did. We didn't interpret the data. In our presentation, no one interpreted the data. Mondo just said, here are the haplogroups that we have. We've got some T2Bs, we've got some European, we've got Druze, we've got Middle Eastern, we've got Caucasus. That rewrites history.
What did their eyes look like, L.A.?
Well, the eye sockets are much larger, much more robust in many of the skulls.
Are they like alien gray sockets?
No, not like that at all. They're not wrap around, but they're much larger. They're much, much larger.
And they would have a regular nose and mouth?
Don't know.
Really? You
don't
can't
know.
Tell?
Don't know. It's according to, and this is the work of forensic artist Marcia Moore, who's spent a lot of time.
Hold on for that question when we come back. L.A. Marzulli with us. And again, get up to coasttocoastam.com. Look at the pictures and the video that they provided for us. Amazing. We're going to come back. We'll talk more and take calls next.